From the Atlantic to the Pacific, across the islands of the Caribbean, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we're pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here. Yes, it is July. You've seen all the news reports about the shark attacks that have been happening really around the southeast, but especially around North Carolina. And why are there more shark attacks occurring? Well, there are plenty of theories out there, and maybe we'll talk about some of those theories. Nobody knows for sure. I have some of my own thoughts. But it occurred to me that this month, July of 2015, is the anniversary of what happened on the 30th of July, 1945. Now, have you ever seen the movie Jaws?
Who hasn't seen Jaws?
Yeah.
Who hasn't seen Jaws?
Who hasn't seen it?
Well, there's a monologue that we're going to play for you that Sam probably has queued up right now.
I do.
And I'm sure as soon as we start playing it, you're going to remember this monologue. It was delivered by the great actor Robert Shaw. And this is a point in the movie when he's the old salty sea captain who's out there on his boat with Richard Dreyfuss and I believe Roy Scheider is the other actor's name. And they're out there on the hunt for Jaws.
Roy Scheider,
is that it? Okay. At one point they're sitting around, it's nighttime, they're having some drinks, and Robert Shaw's character starts talking about his experience with sharks. So give this monologue a listen.
Japanese submarine slammed two torpedoes into our side, Chief. He was coming back from the island of Tinian Delady and just delivered the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. 1,100 men went into the water. Vessel went down in 12 minutes. Didn't see the first shark for about half an hour. Tiger, 13-footer. You know that when you're in the water, Chief? You tell by looking from the dorsal to the tail. Well, we didn't know. Was our bomb mission had been so secret. No distress signal had been sent. They didn't even list as overdue for a week. Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising. So we formed ourselves into tight groups. You know, it's kind of like old squares in a battle, like you see in a calendar, like the Battle of Waterloo, and the idea was, shark comes the nearest man, that man, he start pounding and hollering and screaming, and sometimes the shark go away. Sometimes he wouldn't go away. Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you, right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark, he's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, he doesn't seem to be living until he bites you, and those black eyes roll over white, and then, oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces. You know, by the end of that first dawn, lost 100 men. I don't know how many sharks, maybe 1,000. I don't know how many men, they average 6 an hour. Thursday morning, Chief, I bumped into a friend of mine, Herbie Robinson from Cleveland. Baseball player, bosun's mate. I thought he was asleep. Reached over to wake him up. bobbed up and down in the water. It was like a kind of top. Upended. Well, he'd been bitten in half below the waist. Noon the fifth day, Mr. O'Berry. Lockheed Ventura. So she swung in low and he saw us too. A young pilot, a lot younger than Mr. Hooper anyway. He saw us and he come in low. And 3 hours later, a big fat PBY comes down and start to pick us up. You know, that was the time I was most frightened, waiting for my turn. I'll never put on a life jacket again. So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
What a monologue, huh? In fact, I'll tell you guys something really interesting. In 2012, I was a cast member on a full season of a series on the Travel Channel called Paranormal Paparazzi. And one thing I did was travel around parts of the United States in the field covering stories, often breaking stories regarding, you know, UFOs or skunk ape or whatever people were seeing that was bizarre. And then after I and the other reporters had compiled our stories, they sent all of us to New York, and we stayed there for about a month. And every day we would get up and go into a studio. And in that studio, they shot all of us sitting together talking about our stories. And so if you ever saw Paranormal Paparazzi, you know, they kind of cut back and forth between scenes of us sitting there talking about what we were going to investigate and us being in the field doing our thing. Well, what you find when you work in the TV business is that because showbiz is really kind of a small network, once in a while people will pop up on a set somewhere who just happen to know somebody. They're not necessarily related to the production, and they just hang out for the day. And one day, there was a little buzz on our set. This is in Manhattan. And I looked over, and I saw some of the upper, you know, guys with the production sort of grouping around, clustering around, kind of an old dude with a beard. And I said, "Who's that guy?"
Herbie Robinson from Cleveland.
He was alive! Pretty close. They said, "That is the guy who wrote Jaws." And sure enough, I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember his name right now. Producer Sam, maybe you can jump on Wikipedia.
It wasn't Ludlum, was it?
And so I quickly joined this little cluster of guys who were talking to the man who wrote the screenplay for Jaws. And he was a really nice, jovial fella.
Peter Benchley.
Well, no, Peter Benchley wrote the novel, but this is the guy who adapted it into the screenplay.
Gotcha.
And so here was one of the most interesting parts of my interaction with him and what I learned that day. What is
Carl Gottlieb?
Yeah, that's him. So according to the American Film Institute, they did at some point this big list. They like to do lists. Best villains, top love scenes, whatever. They did a list at one point of, like, the top movie quotes in all time. So you have stuff like, "He is looking at you, kid," right? Or, "There's no place like home," you know, that kind of thing. And I believe that the number one movie quote they came up with, now don't quote me on that, because if it wasn't number one, it was pretty close to the top, but it was, "We're going to need a bigger boat." And so the showrunner on Paparazzi asked him, Mr. Gottlieb, right there in front of all of us, "How did you come up with that great line, 'We're going to need a bigger boat'?" And he said, "I never wrote that line." We said, "Where did it come from?" And he said, Nobody really knows. He said all we can figure is that it was just ad-libbed on the set that day of shooting. And nobody seems, even the actors, don't specifically remember coming up with that line.
And Shaw's long gone.
Yeah.
You can't ask him.
Yeah.
I mean, it would seem that he might have.
He wasn't the one who delivered the line, though.
Yeah,
I think it was.
Well, it wasn't Dreyfus. It was Shaw.
I think it was Roy Scheider who delivered the line. Okay.
We'll find out.
We'll find out. But the interesting thing is that line, yeah, it never actually was written. And when somebody spoke it, and the fact they couldn't remember who came up with it just shows you how much sort of impromptu work takes place sometimes on these movie sets, or especially in particular on that movie set, for them just to not know but include it. And so I thought that was a really interesting, you know, bit of film history, that a line that everybody thought was so perfect was not premeditated.
Mm, you were right. It was Scheider.
It was Scheider. Okay. So we can imagine maybe Roy Scheider came up with it, or maybe, I mean, it literally could have been, knowing how these movies are shot, it could have been like a gaffer or a lighting person who was there who had, you know, a good rapport with the actors and kind of chuckled and said, you should say, you know, we need a bigger boat. And, and then he did it. So I don't know. But to me, that was one of those little interesting brushes that I got to have with Hollywood history, Hollywood legend. I've talked about this before. You know, I think not too long ago I told you that I was working on a Warner Brothers movie, and I ended up in a van next to an old fella, and I didn't know who he was. Turns out he was the guy who shot the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And so that's one of the cool little...
Toby Hooper?
Well, Toby Hooper directed it, but the guy who filmed it... And again, I'm embarrassed to say, I can't remember the name of these people.
It's not a widely known, you know, the...
Yeah, it's like it's the guy... It's always the next dude down, the crew guy, who actually did the work with the rig that, you know, you can't remember his name. But anyway, okay, that said, when we come back from this break, I have in front of me... the actual factual story about what happened to the USS Indianapolis 70 years ago this month. And in a way, the story of what really happened, not only was it very accurately portrayed in many ways by Robert Shaw's monologue, but it's even more disturbing in a way. So when we come back, I will share this with you. You're listening to the program where we dig into the amazing, the remarkable, the downright weird. It's brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop. The number to Wright's, if you don't have it written down already, is 828-298-5402. I'm Joshua P. Warren, and speaking of strange, we'll be right back.
Steel rail, a smile from a veil. Do you think you can tell? Too desperately, but so far has not been fun. I should just stay home. If one thing
Welcome back to Speaking of Strange. I am your host, Joshua P. Warren. Tonight's program is brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop. And you may, and you certainly should, call Wright's Coin Shop at 828-298-5402. Go to speakingofstrange.com for a link to Wright's Coin Shop. Also, the live chat on Speaking of Strange during the show. Regular updates on weird news from around the world. And keep in mind now, we do podcast these programs. So if you can't catch the live show, if you go to speakingofstrange.com, you'll find a section. It's just labeled in the menu as podcast. And you can go back and download MP3s of past shows, or you can subscribe via iTunes. A lot of people are doing that. Be sure if you go to iTunes, you type in Speaking of Strange, all is one word, because there's the old Speaking of Stranges are on there as Speaking of Strange, three separate words. The new ones are all one word. I know that's weird, but that's how it is right now. There's an RSS feed, all kinds of stuff there for you at speakingofstrange.com. Well, if you're just tuning in, here it is July 2015, and it happens to be this month the 70-year anniversary of the horrible sinking of the USS Indianapolis. This was a Portland-class heavy cruiser of the U.S. Navy, and she was a flagship. Her sinking led to the greatest single loss of life at sea in the history of the U.S. Navy. On the 30th of July, 1945, after delivering parts for the first atomic bomb to the United States Air Base at Tinian, the ship was torpedoed by the Imperial Japanese Navy submarine I-58. This ship sank in 12 minutes. There were 1,196 crewmen aboard. Approximately 300 went down with the ship. The remaining 900 faced exposure, dehydration, saltwater poisoning, and shark attacks while floating with the few lifeboats and almost no food or water. The Navy learned of the sinking when survivors were spotted 4 days later by the crew of a PV-1 Ventura on routine patrol. Only 317 survived. So here's how all this happened. The Indianapolis was delivering uranium-235 to Tinian Island as part of the atomic bomb mission. At that time, it was about half of the world's supply of uranium-235. This would end up in the atomic bomb we call Little Boy, which would later be dropped on Hiroshima. The Indianapolis departed San Francisco on the 16th of July, 1945, and after arriving at Pearl Harbor on the 19th of July, she raced on unaccompanied, delivering the atomic weapon components to Tinian on the 26th of July. The Indianapolis was then sent to Guam, where a number of the crew who had completed their tours of duty were replaced by other sailors. Whew, boy, those guys were lucky. Leaving Guam on July 28th, she began sailing toward a place called Leyte, where her crew was to receive training before continuing on to Okinawa. At 2 p.m. on the 30th of July, she was struck on her starboard bow by two Type 95 torpedoes from that Japanese submarine. The explosions caused massive damage. 12 minutes later, she rolled over completely. Then her stern rose into the air, and she plunged down. Again, some 300 of the 1,196 crewmen went down with the ship, with few lifeboats and many without life jackets. The remainder of the crew were set adrift. Now, before we continue on this, let us pause to say, to ask, why did 4 days go by before the Navy knew about this? Well, it turns out that in those days, and during that time when the Navy was very busy, operations to plot the position of these different ships were kept at a headquarters in Guam. And on these boards, the positions of all the vessels were supposed to be plotted. However, for ships as large as the Indianapolis, it was just assumed they would reach their destinations on time unless reported otherwise. And therefore, their positions were based on predictions and not on reports. On the 31st of July, when she should have arrived at Leyte, the Indianapolis was removed from the board in the headquarters there. And she was also recorded as having arrived at Leyte by the headquarters there. The vessel's failure to arrive on schedule was known to a Lieutenant Gibson after reports came in. The Indianapolis did send distress calls before sinking. Three stations received the signals, but no one acted upon the call. One commander was drunk. Another had ordered his men not to disturb him. And a third thought it was a Japanese trap. For a long time, the Navy denied that a distress call had been sent. But it eventually came to light after the release of classified records. So the ship has gone down. These men were thinking, we've sent distress signals. They're keeping up with our schedule. Surely they're going to know where we are. They're going to come and rescue us. And now they're just floating out there. So here are more details on what happened. As these men, the 880 who survived the sinking, were floating around, they suffered from, of course, lack of food and water, exposure to the elements, including hypothermia, dehydration, photophobia, starvation, and dementia. Now, let me pause. Photophobia, if you don't know, is a condition where your eyes become so overwhelmed by bright light that you can't use them properly. It starts giving you severe headaches. You can start hallucinating. They suffered from severe desquamation. This is when your skin starts coming off. And, of course, shark attacks. During this period of time, some of these sailors killed themselves, if they had the means out there. Others were in states of delirium and hallucinations and killed themselves accidentally. As I mentioned earlier, the Discovery Channel Shark Week episode Ocean of Fear says the Indianapolis sinking resulted in the most shark attacks on humans in history. They attribute the attacks to the oceanic white-tip shark species. They think some tiger sharks also killed sailors. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to tell you more about what these men were enduring and how they were finally rescued. Amazing to think about what they went through, and you can see why it inspired that monologue in the movie Jaws. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Yep, we're talking about sharks right now on hour number two, at least for now, of the program where the unusual becomes usual. And I think, well, maybe it will even haunt your nightmares a little bit this evening. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.
What's up, bro? It's your boy, Sinu.
Now I know how to get down on the floor. Experience that moves you can't ignore. But something about this beat that's got me hooked. Come over here and take a closer look. Cause I can't get enough. I can't get enough. I can't stay on the ground. Whoa, I can't get enough. I can't get enough. This is taking me now. It's taking me now. I do this just for kicks, just for the thrill. I got this high without taking a pill. This groove has got me way over the sun. I'm dancing like I am the only one. Cause I can't get enough. I can't get enough. I can't stay on the ground. Whoa, I can't get enough. I can't get enough. This is taking me out. It's taking me out.
You're listening to Speaking of Strange. I am your host, Joshua P. Warren. It's the show where the unusual becomes usual. And, yeah, it's one of those topics that understandably makes you cringe a little bit. But, hey, this is a time when the shark bites and the shark attacks are picking up again. And it also happens to be the 70th anniversary of a horrible incident, the sinking of the USS Indianapolis, which led to the largest tragedy in recorded history of men being eaten by sharks. I'm just going to jump back into the story of what happened to the USS Indianapolis, because here these men are out there for days floating around, unaware of the fact that the Navy doesn't even know that they have sunk. Until finally, a patrol plane flew over and looked down and saw what had happened, saw these men out there on whatever little raggedy makeshift rafts that they had, called this in. A rescue was dispatched. The very first thing the Navy did was send out a seaplane. The seaplane was supposed to fly out there and keep an eye on things until a vessel was able to arrive and rescue the men. But the guys who were flying the seaplane said they were able to look down at the men and actually see them being eaten by sharks from the air. And so the pilot of the seaplane disobeyed his orders not to land. And he went ahead and landed that plane on the water. When he did that, men, as you can imagine, just started swimming over and clambering all over this aircraft, climbing onto the wings, the tail, hanging on to the propeller, whatever they could get. So many men crowded onto this airplane that the plane could never fly again. It had to be sunk. But at least those men were able to get on top of it and stay away from the sharks until the rescue boat arrived to pick them up. Says here, of the original number of men on that ship, the USS Indianapolis, 1,196, ultimately 317 survived. Well, here's, as if that story right there was not tragic enough, well, listen to this follow-up.
Do you have one that's more tragic?
Well, this story is not even over. because the man who had commanded that ship was named Captain Charles B. McVeigh III. He survived the sinking and was with those rescued days later. In November of that year, 1945, he was court-martialed and convicted of, quote, hazarding his ship by failing to zigzag, end quote. Now, there were several things about the court-martial that were controversial. There was evidence the Navy itself had placed the ship in harm's way, and that McVeigh's orders were to zigzag at his discretion, weather permitting. Further, they later talked to the commander of the Japanese submarine. His name was Hashimoto, and he testified that zigzagging would have made no difference. So they ended up remitting McVeigh's sentence and restored him to active duty. He retired 4 years later as a rear admiral. And while many of the Indianapolis survivors said that he was not to blame for the sinking, the families of some of the men who died thought otherwise, and they started harassing him. As a matter of fact, he got a Christmas card shortly after that that said, quote, "Merry Christmas. Our family's holiday would be a lot merrier if you hadn't killed my son," end quote. The guilt that was placed on his shoulders mounted until he committed suicide in 1968 using his Navy-issue revolver. He was discovered on his front lawn with a toy sailor in his hand. Says the day the Indianapolis was sunk was his 47th birthday. In October of 2000, the United States Congress passed a resolution that Captain McVeigh's record should state that, quote, he is exonerated for the loss of the Indianapolis, end quote. President Clinton signed the resolution. The resolution noted that although several hundred ships of the U.S. Navy were lost in combat in World War II, McVeigh was the only captain to be court-martialed for the sinking of his ship. And in July of 2001, the Secretary of the Navy ordered McVeigh's record cleared of all wrongdoing. So just talk about a cursed scenario. Some might say, well, they were delivering parts for the atomic bomb. It was all a very dark, negative scenario. A lot of destructive, terrible, doomed energy surrounding that entire thing.
But wait a minute. Wasn't it the people that they delivered the parts, but then they switched people, didn't they?
Well, some did. Some got to switch off, but not all. The ones who did were a lucky few. Now, here's one thing to keep in mind when you're looking at the bigger picture here of, like, why, what's happening now with all these shark attacks? Why this year do we have all these attacks happening on a scale that we haven't seen, and the latest I heard was something like 15, 20 years. It keeps going up. Well, here's one thing to keep in mind. In 1916, there was a series of shark attacks off the coast of New Jersey that made a lot of news. And we're talking about less than 100 years ago. During that time, when this was getting a lot of attention, most of the mainstream biologists did not believe that sharks actually attacked people. That is how little they knew about sharks. In fact, right here I have in front of me some source material. It says, before 1916, American scholars doubted that sharks would fatally wound a living person in the temperate waters of the United States. There were a lot of, in fact, there was a millionaire who, not long before that, in 1891, named Hermann Ulrich, who offered a reward in the New York Sun for, quote, any authenticated case of a man having been attacked by a shark in the temperate waters north of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. You know what? The reward went unclaimed, and scientists remain convinced that the eastern coast of the United States was inhabited by harmless sharks. Goes on even further. Dr. Henry Weed Fowler, curator of the Henry Skinner Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia asserted that a shark's jaws did not even have the power to sever a human leg in a single bite. This goes on and on. Another report here, scientists said in the Philadelphia Inquirer, quote, it is beyond the power of even the largest shark to sever the leg of an adult. And that there's practically no danger of an attack from a shark about our coast, end quote. So I point that out because if you consider how little humans even knew about other animals 100 years ago, 100 years ago, most people never on this planet had never seen an elephant in person. They'd never, certainly never seen a shark in person. They'd never seen a gorilla in person. You know, we all grew up getting to go to the zoo and to see animals intimately, to watch all these documentaries about animals. And therefore, in my opinion, because of that, people have become more and more and more comfortable getting out there and mingling with animals of all kinds. And the result of that has been the animals have become more and more familiar with us. And so we are more interspersed throughout wild animal populations than we have ever been before. And the more that happens, the more we're going to experience this kind of inevitable consequence. We have to take another break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this, our own views on what might be happening with these sharks. And then I'm going to switch gears, and I have another really interesting story for you that might give you a way of getting messages, or at least understanding messages, coming to you from the universe. Maybe little messages meant just for you. You're going to like this. Stick around for it. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Tonight's program is brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop. You may call Wright's Coin Shop at 828-298-5402 or be sure to check out a link at speakingofstrange.com. The program where the unusual becomes usual will be back right after this.
It's only been a week. The rush of being home and rapid fading, failing to recall what I was missing all that time in England has sent me aimlessly. On foot or by the help of transportation, to knock on windows where a friend no longer live I had forgotten.
Minutes of hour number two on tonight's Speaking of Strange. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Coming up next hour, well, we call it the Dark 30 Hour, and that's when we talk about some of the more outrageous and controversial news stories, not for the kiddies, not for the easily offended, so you can decide whether or not you want to stick around for that. We're finishing a conversation here about, well, sharks, and yeah, it's that time of year. I just gave, before we went to break, some of my thoughts on why we are seeing more shark activity. Sam, surely you have an opinion.
Well, it's not my opinion. It's one that I gleaned from watching Shark Week.
Right.
And it makes sense. Basically, you know, millions of sharks get killed every year by humans, which seems like an excessive number. It seems like a lot. A lot of it apparently is just for the fins. And that's really not good at all. And, like, what happens is they chop the fins off. They shove the still living, soon to be dead shark back in the water. It's awful. But that shark, as it's dying, it's releasing chemicals into the water. Apparently, it's been proven that sharks, when they smell this this aroma of dying or dead shark, it makes them leave the premises. Well, if this is happening on a grand scale all over the globe, they would be leaving, trying to get away to somewhere where that's not happening, which is more concentrated areas such as off the coast of North Carolina, where there's not a whole lot of shark finning, you know, going on.
Well, hey, that makes sense. That is a very good theory. Shelley, do you have any thoughts?
Nope.
All right. Well, there you go.
No, I like Sam's thought. Well, and then Lauren had a good thought.
I have an email you're going to like even more.
Yes.
Because the email starts off going in one direction, but then there's a P.S. about you. And you don't know this, so I'm just breaking this on the air to embarrass you. No, actually, listen, I got this email, and of course I get a lot of emails from fans all the time, but I've never gotten one that has a subject line like this one. Subject is, Forrest is right. Now, we're talking, yes, Hardwood Forrest Connor.
Maybe they're catching up on, like, the old episodes?
That's what's happening.
Oh, okay.
Yes. This is a man. I won't give his last name. His first name is Andrew, and he is a scientist in California. And let me first tell you what he wrote, because sure enough, he's going back, and he's looking at these old episodes. He said, actually, old editions, as we call them. He says, I was working my way through the archive, and I came across where Forrest recounts a coincidence where you might be reading a word, and maybe on the TV they say the same word at the same time. This has happened to me at least three times in recent months. Forrest pondered that if you put all of these coincidence words together, they might actually say something, like perhaps, duck, you idiot. Which is exactly what they would say to Forrest, right? It says, I just made reading. Let's see. I just made that up. He says, anyway, I think it's an important observation. I think it's more important than the 11-11 phenomenon. He says, anyway, I'm going to start writing them down. My coincidence word today is resurrection. He says, I was reading a tweet, and at the exact same time I was reading that word, someone said it on TV. I think it's a very interesting thing. It is a phenomenon, and perhaps someone is trying to communicate with us. When I read that word today, they were not being used in a religious context. Now, let me pause there to say, I think, you know, there may actually be something to this. But then he goes on to say, P.S., can you set me up on a date with Shelley? Huh. She's sweet, smiley face.
Smiley.
Now, you were sitting there worried the whole time, weren't you, Shelley?
I was. I'm like, oh, my gosh, what did it say? What did I?
A scientist in California wants to go on a date with you.
That is very sweet.
May I interject before we go to break? I have at my house right now a book that I write down every single time that something happens, whether it be I'm texting a word and I hear it on TV, or somebody says a word as I'm thinking it, I write it down.
So you're doing this?
With a date next to it every single time. And or I try to every single time to see if there is a pattern. Or in my mind, I didn't think it was somebody trying to communicate with me. I thought maybe it would end up being the Great American Novel or something like that. And so I've read them in order, trying to, like, see if there's couplets or any kind of, you know, meaning. And, you know, it could be some weird abstract poetry or something. But it's very odd. I mean, is it not odd that you would read that and I actually do that and I did it today?
That is amazing.
Maybe he's trying to communicate with me! Andrew!
If only we had more time to dig into this. It's gotten so juicy. Thank goodness there will be another episode.
Maybe in a few years I'll be right. I'll be like, Sam was right!
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, yes, it will be time for the Notorious Dark 30 Hour. Who knows what messages we'll get then. And you'll be right here with us if you so choose. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange. 7 years of bad.